fingers on the trigger, such as Yemen, had entered the field, and if the energy economy and trade in the Persian Gulf had been disrupted, then what achievement would remain for the supporters of aggression against Iran? It was precisely for this reason that Washington, in a state of panic through intermediaries, proposed an immediate ceasefire to Iran. On June 23, 2025, the second imposed military war against the Islamic Republic of Iran came to an end after 12 days. Although from the very first hours of accepting the ceasefire proposed by the West, the war of narratives began, aiming to portray Israel and the U.S. as victors, awaken consciences, and above all, the people of the region and the Iranian nation knew who the true winner of Iran's struggle against the entire world of domination was.
It has taken Israel's high command just 12 days to see that total victory they claim to have achieved in the first hours of their blitz on Iran turned something that looks much more like a strategic defeat. This 12-day war ended with none of Israel's three war aims being met. Trump's claim that Iran's nuclear enrichment program had been completely and fully obliterated has within a day been flatly contradicted by the intelligence arm of the Pentagon, who sent in the B-2 bombers.
The reason you had a 12-day war was first and foremost because the Israelis were running out of missiles, running out of the means to defend themselves.
Yeah.
Israel was being crushed in one barrage after another of very accurate and devastating missile fire from...
Iran hasn't been defeated. In fact, Iran has punched back very hard against Israel, and Iran still has the ability to intimidate the United States.
Beyond. But no, Israel is not a regional military hegemon and cannot dictate the future shape of the Middle East. The price it has had to pay is high. It has swapped Hamas's homegrown rockets for Iran's ballistic missiles. It has swapped an indirect enemy who uses proxies for a direct one, which has now no hesitation in keeping the entire population of Israel in its bunkers. Netanyahu's lifelong dream of slaying the Iranian dragon may have proved to be a bridge too far.
At the end of these 12 days, Israel not only failed to achieve its initial declared objectives of causing the collapse of Iran's governance, but the military power of Iran, which was supposed to be destroyed, turned into its bane. The U.S. success in destroying Iran's nuclear facilities was also met with serious doubt from experts due to the ambiguous and meaningful silence of the Iranian officials. Thus, the disgraceful and historic memory of the White House's cooperation with the aggression of the Israeli regime was this time etched into history with their failure to achieve their declared goals. Now, the Israeli regime, with its long list of war crimes, such as attacks on ambulances, rescue teams, and medical centers, assaults on scientific and research institutions, assassinations of scientists, intimidation of civilians, and attacks on media centers such as the IRIB and the Central Building of Islamic Radio and Television Union, awaits the consequences of what it has committed. And the U.S., with its lost prestige due to insults and offenses against diplomatic values, stands dishonored with its shattered grandeur at the hands of the Iranians. Meanwhile, along with the sense of pride and the rising spirit of sacrifice among the people, it is the flag of honor and dignity of the Islamic Republic of Iran that has been raised high through the readiness of its sons for struggle across the world, even though in this celebration of victory, we miss many great and small heroes of the homeland.
what you sow. And when you do good, Allah will protect you and stop you falling down. Allah, we surrender, 'cause he knows all, no compromise. Hears your laugh and feels your cry, he is there all the time. Make dua, praise Allah, our iman will grow. Inshallah, we will go far, there's a long way to go. We praise Allah, it's from the heart, love will keep us whole. And when you're feeling down, you know the way to go.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asl zinda dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. Please stay tuned.
بخشه به قدر به اندازه یک سال مقدرات تقدیر میشه چون آیه دیگه داریم.
On the night of Qadr or decree, the decrees for the entire year are ordained. Because another ayah in Surah Ad-Dukhan, ayah 4, states, during it the night is made distinct, every precise matter. On that night, every firm and decisive matter, that is the decrees, is specified and distinguished. Who will have a child from now until 3 years later? Who will lose their child, who will become happy, what bitter or sweet events will occur for them. Indeed, we revealed it during the night of decree.
قدر سه تا معنی داره. یکی قدر یعنی منزلت، میگیم فلانی قدر و منزلت داره یعنی مقام.
Qadr has three meanings. Number one, Qadr means status, rank, honor. We say so and so has Qadr, meaning they have a status. Laylatul Qadr means a night with a status and value. Number two, Qadr means measurement, determining the measure. Both the first and second meanings fit this ayah. We revealed it during Laylatul Qadr, meaning a night of great honor, or a night wherein measurements and degrees take place. And number three, Qadr can also mean constriction and tightness. For instance, in the sentence, he whose provision is constricted. But this third meaning does not fit here. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. To find out more about this program and our other programs, please log on to our website, iranradio.ir. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Lifestyle is not just about how we live, but why we live that way, the choices that quietly shape our values and relationships and the direction of our soul. Welcome, dear brothers and sisters, to your program Viewpoint from IRIB English Radio. This is the humble host of the show. The program, Sayyid Ali, is here, and I am joined by two dear brothers, Sheikh Hussein. Assalamu alaikum, dear brother.
Alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah.
Good to have you here. And Sheikh Liaghat Hakim, salam alaykum, dear brother.
Thank you so much. Alaykum as-salam wa rahmatullah.
Thank you both for being here. So, gonna start the conversation with Brother Hussein. Many young people today search for meaning beyond material success. According to the leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, why is defining a higher goal essential for a meaningful lifestyle?
Well, actually, this question of the meaning of life is as old as humanity.
And I would say that some generally people do not come across this question until they get a bit serious with their life.
Exactly.
So it's true that after you become like a teenager, you still are discovering yourself, and then you start your early young ages. Still, you're trying to find yourself. And then you realize that, yes, now is the time that I should think about what I'm going to do with myself and with my life. And then here comes the big question that, what's the meaning of life altogether? And for some people, it happens earlier. For some people, it happens deeper. But I would think that everyone to some extent have or has this question. So it depends on how much profound you have when you have gone into the answer of this question, that what kind of lifestyle you're going to build up on it. That if your answer to this question that, yes, I'm going to have this life, I'm going to have like a family and stuff like that, it's not bad, but it's a very shallow and superficial level of answer to this question.
It's like you just want to use the footprint of your ancestors and go through the stages that they have been through.
That's something like that. Everybody else, what they do, and I do it. And so I'm not saying it's bad, but for relatively many people, especially at our age, it's not satisfying that, okay, I'm going to do whatever they do. We eat, we sleep, we wake up, we work, and then we die. It's finished. This would be. But then...
What's then? The question of what's then? How do you make of it?
Yeah.
I mean, what...
So I think the leader tries to say that the lifestyle that you create is influenced heavily by the answer to that you give to the question of the meaning of life. If the answer to your question is one typical answer, well, your lifestyle would be following the same suit. And you don't even realize, as I said in the other program, that the person doesn't realize that he's following a lifestyle of this celebrity, of that person, of that culture. Why? Because to begin with, he has based his life on everything that just comes along the way.
Mm-hmm.
In our riwayat, we have this term, hamajun ru'a, for these people.
Which means
like the cattle that would go from the herd, that would go from here to there without even understanding. Mm-hmm. There is this word for it even in social sciences. They say herd behavior, something like this, that people act without knowing why they are acting like this. So this is hamajun ru'a. But there are people, according to the same riwayah, that know muta'alliman ala sabil al-najat. He is learning and he is trying to arrive at a meaningful point, which is called salvation or redemption, sabil al-najat, to get rid of some of the main problems. So, and then there's alim al-rabbani, a divine scholar who actually leads the way for the muta'allim ala sabil al-najat. So, according to this hadith, people are one of these three groups. You don't have any fourth group. It's either a person is either a leader or a follower, and these followers either they have a principle, muta'allim ala sabil al-najat. So, when they follow, they know why they are following the leader.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have hamajun ru'a. When they follow, they don't know why they're following. They just follow.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. So, but I'm going to ask, I got a question. So I'm going to ask for you, dear Sheikh Liaqat, that those people who define their meaning of their life simpler for themselves, they would say, okay, I'm just going to be happy. I'm just going to help other people. That's it. That's my golden rule of thumb of my life. They would be happier in life. Just imagine those people who just want to define a very sophisticated meaning of pursuing a monotheistic way of life to become a great divine scholar. Those people have chosen a great plate before them, so they have to try more to fill in it. So is it better to choose a simpler line or goal for yourself, or no, life is like more complicated than this?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I would say life is more complicated. Of course, there's a golden maqsad or a golden rule in your life, I would say, a golden goal which you want to keep for yourself. But if we consider the point which the Supreme Leader has kept, that is lifestyle from a religious perspective, okay, I think that would become more meaningful. That would give more meaning to our life. If you consider an example, like a person, what is your point of life? If you ask a person, for a few people, becoming rich is the goal of life, or I would say the golden rule in their life. So for them, they will do anything just to get rich.
Okay? Exactly.
For other people, it's only that they are on the path of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. I am on that path which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants. So my lifestyle will be according with in accordance to the rules of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
Example, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants me to be kind, I'll be kind. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants me to be humble, I'll be humble. So my lifestyle will be a kind lifestyle, will be a humble lifestyle, yeah. And when the path has a lot of criterias in it kept, example,
sure.
Like being humble, being kind, being generous, being, example, charitable, yeah, then it becomes more difficult. For the other person, it's just getting rich.
Exactly.
So it doesn't matter if it is through a halal income, through a haram income. Example, I'm
and
just giving
justify
it.
The means. Yeah,
yeah. It's just that if I'm rich, I'm good with it. This is my lifestyle. I want a rich lifestyle. Okay, so as for the other person, because the criteria are increasing, so it might become difficult in the beginning, in the initial stage. It might look difficult, but I would say the easiest lifestyle, which has been chosen by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for us, is the Islamic one, is the lifestyle based on faith.
Exactly.
Which the Supreme Leader points towards it. Why? Because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala doesn't want difficulty upon us. He wants ease. It is us who choose a difficult path. So from the worldly perspective, becoming rich is an easy part, or an easy way of life to be led onto. Is an easy lifestyle example.
Yeah.
But from an Islamic perspective, from the perspective of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala or the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, from a Quranic perspective, if we see and take into consideration, the easy life is the life in which there are commandments of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The rules are by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Because Allah knows what is easy for a human being.
Mm-hmm.
So that which is easy for a human being will be selected by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And that which is difficult will not be selected. And if this very path of kindness, humbleness, and generous, and those things which are liked by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala are kept in place, then other things will also fall in its place. Example, if we consider, I'm just taking an example over here,
mm-hmm.
Prophet Sulaiman alayhi salam, okay? He was rich, but he had a lifestyle based on the path of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He never went against Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yeah.
You see? So likewise, if I really, okay, just taking into consideration, I really want to get rich because I love money. Okay?
Sure.
I want to get rich. I want a lavish lifestyle. If I follow the path of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, Ya Ilahi, oh Allah, I want a life, a lavish life based on what your likes are, then Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala can help him. He can be rich and he can still be on the path of Islam, meaning he will be on a religious, on a faith-based lifestyle, which is liked by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and still live a lavish life, and still live a luxurious life, rather than just a person living just a rich and luxurious and lavish life and not following the religion of Islam.
Yeah, there's a difference. Yeah, exactly. And I think we cannot, set a very sharpened aim for the meaning of our life ahead of us at the first early stage of our life. You know, it gets clearer whenever you go through different stages of your life.
Definitely, indeed.
So, dear brother Sheikh Hussein, in a world of constant change, ignorance is vulnerability. Why does the leader of revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, describe knowledge as a source of honor, power, and security?
Well, actually, I strongly believe that he is inspired in this by the Islamic teachings. Actually, there's this hadith that the Prophet said that the person who is al-alamu bi-zamana, a person who knows his time okay? Mm. It might be about the changes of the time or anything. لا تهجم عليه اللوابس. So the problems, ambiguities will not invade him, something like this, okay? So if you are not aware, if you're ignorant, if you're not aware of what's going on around you, then you will be surrounded by things that are unfamiliar and exotic to you, and you will be consumed by them. So that is one Islamic teaching. Another Islamic teaching is that al-ilmu sultan, the knowledge is the source of power. And if you have knowledge, you will have power. Otherwise, you will be subjugated by others. So I think, strategically speaking, there are different layers of meaning for this saying and this perspective of knowledge that the leader reflects in his saying. So strategically speaking, for Muslim communities, for Muslim nations, this has been a source of problem since the fall of Muslim golden ages, Islamic golden ages, that we have lost our historical self-awareness, consciousness, and unfortunately, we see this kind of a struggle among Muslim nations about their own fate in human history. And at the level of individuals, if you want to take control over your life, if you want to do things beneficial for yourself and for your community, well, you have to know things. Again, there's this thing, Islamic teaching, that a person who wants to reform should have the proper knowledge for it. Otherwise, he will destroy more than rectifying or correction that he's going to make.
Yeah.
So, at different levels, knowledge and full awareness of all different angles and all different aspects of the project that you're aiming to do is actually coming first than everything else.
Okay, thank you so much for both of you for being here, and may God grant us wisdom to understand and learn deeper understanding about Islamic way of life and practice the life that he prefers for us, because indeed it's the life that suits our physical and spiritual lives. Till another episode, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Shining bright, you came to us with a heart so full of love, and you showed that you're the one who cares the most, and to us you've always been so close. Everyone will say, please say, accept al-Habib. Ummati, Ummati, yaquluha lana yawm al-qiyamati. Ummati, Ummati, yaquluha shafa'atan ana laha.
What about you? IRIB English Radio.
But let's start with this unrecognized and, to me, bizarre, you can probably shed some light on it, meeting back in July between Jonathan Pollard and Mike Huckabee. Huckabee is, of course, the Zionist U.S. ambassador to Israel. followed is the notorious theft of American national security secrets. Is Pollard a hero to the Israelis?
Well, he is, and he's a settler who is sort of a local celebrity among the religious nationalist world. I remember there's this bookstore I used to walk by in central Jerusalem where a lot of settlers would frequent when they came into Jerusalem to go shopping and so on, buy frozen yogurt. And it had a giant picture of Jonathan Pollard over the front door, because at that time he was considered cause celebre to the religious nationalist movement and kind of a political prisoner in Israel. And that was the main bookstore where settlers could get messianic texts and so forth. So he's a hero to a certain constituency in Israel. And through the Adelson bribery network, Miriam and Sheldon Adelson, Donald Trump was basically paid to release him. He was sentenced to life in prison. Jonathan Pollard was sentenced to life in prison for some of the most damaging intelligence thefts in U.S. history. He was a naval intelligence analyst. He did this for ideological reasons, because he believed he was an Israel firster. And he handed over the methods that the NSA used to collect intelligence to the Mossad, as well as a list of thousands of intelligence contacts, collaborators, undercover spies, the knock list that U.S. intelligence used to Tel Aviv. He did this in exchange for money, but for ideological reasons. Ultimately, Donald Trump released him, and Sheldon Adelson flew him back to Israel on his personal jet, where he is now sort of a hero. And for some reason, Mike Huckabee last July, what I call the Israeli-U.S. reciprocal ambassador, decided to meet with Jonathan Pollard in his office. And this came as news to me, but it also came as news to the White House and to the CIA. None of them knew about this. And this should be a fireable offense, considering what Pollard did to the United States. I mean, this is Aldrich Ames level spying. This is treachery. He is a traitor. What was Huckabee doing with him? No U.S. ambassador has previously met with him, but it does appear that Huckabee has ideological kinship with Jonathan Pollard. Huckabee is a Pollardite, and if Huckabee isn't fired for this, we have to ask, in what world, in what political movement, in what White House does he not get fired? It's one that believes in MEGA, making Israel great again.
Well, it wasn't on his schedule, and the press knew nothing about it. I didn't know about it until you told us a little while ago, and then I looked it up, and it just came out, I guess, in the past few days. So Huckabee must have known he needed to keep this secret from the CIA, from other embassy employees, and from the White House. I bet he didn't keep it secret from Benjamin Netanyahu.
Well, he didn't keep it secret from other figures in the Trump administration, because it looks like they went to the New York Times. Three current senior officials confirmed this to the New York Times. So it looks like this is an internal problem. And it's something that I've been seeing from inside the Trump administration. There are still forces in the Trump administration that are deeply uncomfortable with the personnel in control of the policy, because they consider themselves to be Israel firsters, or, as one Trump administration source called them to me, Mossad stenographers.
You know, Mike Huckabee, and I know him well, Max, because he was full-time at Fox for about 2 or 3 years during the much longer time that I was there, but I didn't know now what I now know about him.
Yeah.
He is what Tucker Carlson is being excoriated for condemning, a Christian nationalist who puts Israel above the United States, an arch Zionist. Now, I don't know how a human being nominated by the president, confirmed by the Senate, the official government representative of another country, can put that other country first and expect to get away with it.
Well, all the other previous U.S. ambassadors that I can think of were Israel firsters. Even under Joe Biden, Tom Nides, for example. I mean, after October 7th, he went and lobbied on behalf of the Jewish federations for more money to support Israel during its genocide. Before that, you know, under Obama, Daniel Shapiro, he stayed in Israel with his family. When his term ended, and went on to lobby for the NSO group, which produces Pegasus spyware. You had David Friedman from the first Trump ambassador to Israel. This is a figure who has a part-time residence, I think, in the settlement of Beit El, is part of the Friends of Beit El, raises money for the illegal settlements from the U.S., is a complete Israel firster. I mean, he doesn't – he wakes up in the morning, maybe eats some cereal, and then lobbies for Israel. That's what he does with his life. But what Huckabee has done here is an act of just such naked treason to associate and welcome and as someone who betrayed the United States at such a high level that I don't understand how Trump can protect him anymore unless Trump is that fully invested himself in the Israel First program, or that this would be just too embarrassing for him. It's really Trump at this point, he has to choose between Adelson and the CIA.
How does Huckabee explain this to the White House now, which I he must have done by now since the time the New York Times piece appeared?
It was like Pollard was like crashing some party, or he broke in somehow. I don't know. I don't understand what the excuse would be.
Let's talk about another Israel firster who happens to be the United States ambassador to the UN. Why were Danny Dannon, that thug that is the Israeli ambassador to the UN, and Mike Waltz embracing each other on the floor of the Security Council earlier this week?
Yeah, a really tragic moment in the history of the UN as the Gaza Master Plan passed. And this is a plan to essentially internationalize the occupation of Gaza and a Trojan horse for permanent Israeli control and a colonial program that I can explain in a little bit more detail in a minute, but which was approved, voted for by the one Arab state on the Security Council in a non-permanent role, Algeria, and the one Muslim state in a non-permanent role, Pakistan. Two countries that had feigned concern for Gaza for the last 2 years. And then behind them, you have Turkey, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Egypt, you know, the so-called the Arabs and the Muslim states that are vying for a role as part of this international stabilization force, which is really a pacification force whose mission will be to disarm Palestinian resistance factions and put Palestinians at the mercy of the Israeli army, but behind an international flag. Now, Turkey has said that disarming Hamas without ending the occupation would be a red line. So why do they want to be involved in this? Have they spoken out against this resolution? Now you have the two permanent members that would normally veto such a thing, Russia and China. They both abstained. Russia's abstention, I think, will be as consequential, if not more, than its abstention on the vote to declare Libya a no-fly zone, which was part of what convinced Putin to run for president again, because that was during the time of Medvedev. This, what explains the Russian and Chinese votes, given that they harshly condemned the resolution and offered the same analysis that I just did, that it's a Trojan horse for reoccupation, that it will violate international law and so forth? They claim that they couldn't abstain, they couldn't actually veto it when you have all of the Arab states, which are basically vassals, being in favor of this international force. And after they vetoed it, you have the Palestinian Authority, the Vichy Authority that collaborates with Israel to rule the West Bank, supporting this vote. So what you've seen is the complete betrayal of Gaza by the Arab and Muslim world, and Russia and China failing to step in because I guess they don't want to complicate their relations with Turkey and Egypt and all these other mid-level powers. And Gaza is now at the mercy of what Jared Kushner called the master plan, which I can explain, but which is essentially a colonial divide and conquer plan that continues the genocide under international cover.
And will this master plan permit Jared Kushner to become the development for the very valuable waterfront real estate?
I should actually clarify, it was Steve Witkoff who referred to it as a master plan in a 60 Minutes interview, and Jared Kushner was seated beside him, and he grimaced with so much agony because Witkoff had let the cat out of the bag.
Didn't the vice president let the cat out of the bag in a similar environment where he referred to Kushner as the investor?
Yeah. I mean, Kushner is the investor in a company that has proposed Gaza seafront real estate. Kushner has himself referred to Gaza as ideal waterfront real estate property. So absolutely, Kushner is interested in the master plan. If you look at the map right now, there's this yellow line that Israel has set up preventing Palestinians from reaching the arable areas that used to be agricultural land. It cuts them off from everywhere east of Gaza City all the way down to east of Khan Yunis. Rafah is completely destroyed in the south, so there's this giant buffer, and Israel's occupying that as well as the Netzarim corridor. And that yellow line confines the population of Gaza into basically a concentration camp where Israel and the United States military, through its new Civil Military Coordination Center in the Israeli city of Kiryat Gat, control all the access points for aid. They're dumping cell phones into Gaza today. There are images of tons of cell phones being offloaded into Gaza for obvious reasons, spying and spreading destabilization. Then what Israel's going to do is in those areas where they're carrying out demolitions, where Palestinians are not allowed to go, where they're being killed if they go, outside the yellow line, which is 58% of the Gaza Strip, they're going to create these so-called model cities. We've seen the maps for them in the Boston Consulting Group plans, and they're really like gated communities where everything will be digitized, like the nightmare that everyone who opposed the COVID lockdowns had of 20-minute cities and globalist control. It will be fulfilled there. Everyone will be living in these biometric gated communities. Businesses will be blacklisted that do not comply with Israel, and those that are whitelisted will be run by future warlords. And the United Arab Emirates will be one of the Arab authorities administering things financially, but cash will be virtually this will be sort of a cashless society. Everything will be digitized and tokenized, biometric. Everyone will be under mass surveillance. And then anyone who remains back in the areas that were controlled by resistance factions, Palestinian grassroots factions, they will be subjected to more starvation sieges and continuous bombardment unless they move to the model areas. That's the future of the master plan until they get those areas on the waterfront for Jared Kushner and his buddies.
Gee, I wonder who will build the digital infrastructure. Probably the same people that threw you out. Palantir, probably the same people that threw you out of that conference where you tried to question them.
Well, Palantir has been heavily involved by the admission of its CEO, Alex Karp, who was just at the U.S.-Saudi Investment Forum at the Kennedy Center down the street. 2 days ago, Alex Karp has boasted about his role in providing Israel with targeting assistance through Palantir's Maven system and participating openly in the genocide. And in the Boston Consulting Group plans for the so-called master plan, various multinational corporations, tech corporations, were put forward for contracts, Oracle, Amazon, Palantir being just among a few of those that control our media in the United States and our administration.
Well, I want to get to Venezuela and the CIA's cocaine business with you because you've just done some extraordinary reporting on it. But before we do, I'd like you to watch this clip from John Kiriakou.
The reason, though, I'm told, that Donald Trump decided to bomb Iran was that the Israelis said for the first time, if you don't bomb Iran to take out these deep bunkers, we're going to use nuclear weapons. And they had never threatened that before. And so Trump said, bombing Iran might actually save us from the start of World War III if it keeps the Israelis from using nuclear weapons.
So according to your source, the Israelis told the President of the United States that if he did not used the United States military power to bomb the nuclear facilities in Iran, Israel, acting on its own, would use nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
Do you see why there's a problem with that statement, John?
Yeah.
Because they've never admitted that they've had them.
That's right.
So you're telling me that they just admitted to the President of the United States that they have nuclear weapons and we still do not have them in the IAEA treaty.
I mean, if Israeli nuclear whistleblowers are to be believed, yeah, they've had them. They started working on them in the 50s. They got them around the late 60s or the early 70s. Look at Mordechai Vanunu. Mm-hmm. You know, he wasn't charged for treason for nothing.
Is this credible, Max?
It is. Jonathan Pollard. Remember I mentioned him before? We talked about him before, the Israeli spy who was in U.S. Naval Intelligence.
Right.
He gave an interview fairly recently to a fellow settler on a podcast in Israel. And he said that back in 1973, we were on the ropes. And when he says we, even though he was in the U.S., he's referring to the Israelis. The Egyptians had broken across the Sinai and were marching towards Israel proper. The Syrians were attacking from the north. And they wanted Nixon to resupply them with an emergency airlift to save Israel. And so the Israelis took U.S. officials to an airfield, showed them an A-4 jet packed with nuclear weapons, and said, if you do not authorize the emergency airlift, we will use nuclear weapons. And so Pollard is openly boasting about nuclear blackmail carried out by Israel back in 1973. That's what John Kiriakou is referring to. That's Israel's ace card. It's what Seymour Hersh called the Samson option. And the program was exposed by Mordechai Vanunu, one of the bravest whistleblowers in history, who was tortured for decades by Israel for what he did. He was a former worker at the Dimona facility.
Wow. Does the CIA traffic in cocaine?
Well, I referred to them in a debate 2 days ago on Piers Morgan with the former U.S. Ambassador James Story and a former CIA agent who was sort of made famous by Joe Rogan, Mike Baker. I referred to them as the cocaine import agency. The CIA was directly responsible for creating the so-called Cartel of the Suns that is now said to be under the control of Nicolas Maduro, was just named last week by Marco Rubio a narco-terrorist organization to justify striking Venezuela on land, possibly assassinating its leadership. And it's a completely fake construct that was created by the CIA in the early 90s to ship 22 tons of cocaine into the U.S. Now, why would they do that? They thought that this would allow them to surveil the drug running networks through the United States, identify who's selling the drugs, but they wound up poisoning our society, as Marco Rubio claims. And this was just sort of, this is the tip of the iceberg when it comes to the CIA being involved with cartels. The DEA agent who actually realized that the CIA was involved with the Guadalajara cartel in the 1980s and was using the cash to fund black operations run by Ali North in Central America was named Kiki Camarena. And what happened to him? He was tortured for days, tortured to death by Guadalajara cartel members, in the presence of Felix Rodriguez, the notorious CIA agent who, back in the early 60s, presided over the execution of Che Guevara. This is all pretty well-documented stuff. But then we have figures in U.S. federal prisons like Genaro Garcia Luna, who was the most powerful law enforcement security official in Mexico for years under the administrations of Vicente Fox and Felipe Calderon. These are like the two key U.S. allies from the PAN and PRI party. Well, Elliot Abrams seems to think they are because Gargamel has just resurfaced in the pages of Foreign Affairs, the publication of the Council on Foreign Relations, the veteran coup plotter who presided over the El Mozote massacre in El Salvador during the dirty wars of the 80s, who oversaw coup plots in the Gaza Strip against Hamas, who presided over previous coups in Venezuela, all of which failed, and he's now putting forward a plan for a special forces, U.S. special forces attack on Venezuela. So the CIA, I mean, Trump has authorized them to operate in a lethal fashion, essentially overtly in Venezuela. A refinery, petrochemical refinery, just exploded yesterday in a key energy-producing region of Venezuela. I mean, we can put two and two together, but it's pretty rare, if not, it's very rare for a president to announce that the CIA is going to carry out covert activity. It's a psyop that Trump is deploying in order to promote fear and instability among the Venezuelan leadership in hopes that there will be mass defections among generals. But Abrams is now the most senior voice to openly support special forces attacks inside Venezuela. There's another figure named Marshall Billingsley. If you're watching this, go to his Twitter account if you want to see war-crazed, maniacal psychosis in action. He's just tweeting photos of hospitals, high-rise buildings in Caracas, a baseball stadium, fantasizing about U.S. Tomahawk strikes on these structures, and essentially claiming that this is where Maduro's bunkers are or the vice president's bunkers. But these are political officials of a U.N.-recognized government, and he's calling for Israeli-style strikes on hospitals. Marshall Billingsley has worked in administration since the George W. Bush era, was testifying in Congress last October, was Trump's key guy on sanctions on Venezuela. So this is not some nobody, and this is where their thinking is going. There's only one person who can stop this crazy train, and it's Donald Trump, and I don't know if he has it in him.
He's the engineer of the train. Before we go, from Elon Musk.
You know, people often talk about sort of eliminating poverty and that kind of thing, but really how long have they been talking about that? There's lots of talk, there's lots of NGOs sort of trying to do these things, but really not succeeding. And you know, the evidence speaks for itself. But AI and humanoid robots will actually eliminate poverty. And Tesla won't be the only one that makes them. I think Tesla will pioneer this, but there will be many other companies that make humanoid robots. But there is only basically one way to make everyone wealthy, and that is AI and robotics.
What the hell is he talking about? AI and robotics are going to make everybody wealthy and eliminate poverty. You get it?
Well, they're going to make everyone unemployed, and then everyone's going to have to live off universal basic income as the man seated to Elon Musk's left, Jensen Huang, who's the CEO of NVIDIA, said right after Elon Musk. What Elon Musk is saying makes absolutely no sense. And it shows that in the world of AI and tech, there is a messianic mentality that is being fueled by massive infusions of cash that is leading to nowhere. They talk about all the energy they need, all the gigawatts they need, but they don't exactly know what they need it for. They don't have a clear budget. Elon Musk has gotten his board of directors to approve a $1 trillion pay package for himself. Where's the money going to come from? And they're at the Saudi U.S. Investment Forum at the Kennedy Center, which was a grotesque gallery of corporate looters and Saudi monarchs and their lobbyists and Donald Trump, a real portrait of American governance at a late and decadent stage. And the Saudi Public Investment Fund, which is actually not as flush with cash as we think it is, has failed on several white elephant projects like Project NEOM, which was to align Saudi Arabia's coasts with resorts and high-speed rail and is going absolutely nowhere, has ponied up $600 billion for these AI warlords, these messianic figures, including Elon Musk, who are seeking more and more cash so they can say that that their earnings have gone up, even though they're not actually selling a product that is profitable at this point. Saudi Arabia generates about $1 trillion every year. So it doesn't have $600 billion to give to them. I don't know where the money is going to come from. This was just the strangest spectacle of financial fantasy
And essentially what we're witnessing is a kind of Ponzi scheme in which all of this money is being directed into AI, our money, Saudi money, but it's not coming back. It's not necessarily creating jobs. It's causing consumers to pay more for electricity bills through all these data centers. And it's fueling a bubble, much like the dot-com bubble of the 1990s. And if you look at NVIDIA's earnings, you have all of these investors with short positions on NVIDIA right now. NVIDIA's taking in all this money, but it's not actually generating anything. It looks like the bubble could burst and do irreparable harm to the U.S. economy. And we're going to go back and look at that scene there of Elon Musk predicting the end of poverty and gather up our pitchforks.
You mean Donald Trump's sons will not get to build Trump Towers in Saudi Arabia?
I don't know what they're building, but props to Eric Trump and his crypto business, which has taken in $1 billion of completely opaque bribes for the Trump family from often foreign governments and foreign figures. We'll never know who they are. That was impressive.
Good morning to you all. You're listening to Iran Radio from Tehran. I'm Asma, your presenter for the next hour. We start this hour's program with our news bulletin that will be followed by our varied radio productions feature. After that, we have A to Z of Life. The program presents an Islamic Iranian lifestyle in a variety of ways, making use of the ayahs of the Holy Quran as well as inspirational poetry and stories. And to round up this hour's program, two episodes of our varied radio productions feature is broadcast.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Top headlines. Hamas says Israel continues to allow only a limited number of aid trucks into Gaza, which do not meet the minimum of people's basic needs. Palestinian resistance fighters carry out another operation against Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank, injuring at least one of the regime's troops. And finally, Iran's foreign minister says Washington must first regain Tehran's trust before returning to diplomacy with the Islamic Republic. Hello and welcome everyone, your world news. Let's go ahead and get started with the stories that matter. More Palestinian civilians fall victim to Israeli forces' attacks across the besieged Gaza Strip as the regime presses ahead with its blatant violations of the ceasefire deal with Hamas. According to Gaza's health ministry, one Palestinian was shot dead on Monday in an Israeli drone attack in the Zaytun neighborhood of Gaza City. 9 bodies were also retrieved from under the rubble.